Everybody. My name is Suvi Keskinen, and today I will be interviewing Nirmal Pubar, who is a professor in media communications and cultural studies at Goldsmiths University in London. And Nirmal has been visiting our project and giving an open lecture at the University of Helsinki, meeting up with the project, and we thought that it would be really nice to record a podcast episode at the same time. And Nirmal has a long history of working with creative methods, or what actually later came to be named as creative methods. Maybe it was not there to start with, but afterwards people have got to know these methodological perspectives as creative methods. And we will delve into some of that work by Nirmal and her colleagues and some themes related to her research in this episode. So, thanks, Nirmal, for joining us. And I'd like to start with a question going a bit back in time, like how did you embark on or overall get to be interested and start to use these kinds of creative, art-based, participatory methods? How did that all start?
Firstly, I'd like to say thank you, Suvi, for inviting me to meet your faculty and your amazing project team. We've had such rich discussions. So how did I start embarking on creative methods? As you say, it wasn't called creative methods. I didn't intend to create an area either. I've always had a very broad understanding of the social sciences. And in fact, before I decided to study sociology at school level, this is before university, the book that really influenced me was Ways of Seeing by John Berger. Because at that point, I was 16, I didn't really understand what sociology was. So I went to my local library, which was a 2-minute walk from my family home. And there I find in the sociology section the text Ways of Seeing. I looked through that text, I read it, I can't say I understood it all, but I thought, if this is what sociology is, then that's what I want to do. In my undergraduate teaching, I did specialise in sociology, it was in a broader degree on the social sciences. And we were taught the history of ideas. So you would study so many different disciplines at the same time. And this meant that I never entered sociology through a narrow passageway. It was always a heterodoxy of disciplines. And I wasn't used to boundaries being imposed on me because of the way I was taught. The same with my MA. I did it in social and political thought at the Essex University, and scholars came from philosophy, political science, economics. And alongside that, when I was a child, my father actually retired from Ford, the car plant industry, the factory floor, and went to work in a gallery, in a local gallery called the Herbert Art Gallery. He didn't see it as a particularly onerous job. He worked as an attendant, mainly at night. And it reminds me of some of the figures in the film Handsworth Songs by Jeanne Comfrey, where there's often a racialized figure of being an attendant who oversees the collections. And so during the holidays, sometimes summer holidays, he would work in the daytime as well. And me, my mum, and my two nephews, who were more like my siblings, would meet him at lunchtime. So going to the gallery became a regular practice. And I would also say my state schooling was a very mixed learning experience. So our teachers did take us to theatres, cultural places that you might think working class kids would not go to. So that exposure was there. And the methods, I always liked methods as a student. I wasn't so good at the statistical methods. I wish I was, but I wasn't. I did, however, do in-depth qualitative research very early on. I had one of these unusual degrees. In the UK, we called them sandwich degrees, undergraduate degrees. And you spent 1 year away from the university, either in an NGO or voluntary capacity or a company. I worked in an Asian women's refuge. So where people who have women experience domestic violence go for security. That was my first experience of immersive ethnography. So that was built up over time. And visual analysis of visuals wasn't actually part of my learning, but I didn't see it being something separate from me either, because a lot of cultural theory, cultural analysis, the people we read, such as Stuart Hall, Paul Gilroy, they often wrote essays that wrote about the story of empire, disrupting those stories, using art practices. And so even though I didn't do a formal education in art or art history, and I'm certainly don't see myself as an artist or art historian, it was certainly part of the visual, the aural was a part of the way in which one would understand the texture of social life and therefore intervene with it as well.
Yeah, sounds like it was also like partly your own interest, but also very much in the academic environment and the ways the discussions were going and the teachers you had and so forth. What do you think, like, do you think you still have the same motivation or has this kind of working with a longer time with these kind of creative methods, has that somehow led you to think otherwise on these reasons of engaging in this way in research?
Yeah, I suppose I've taken an active, intentional stance over the years. So with my colleagues at Goldsmiths and Sociology Department in 2005, we formulated a loose group called the Methods Lab. And one of the key elements of the Methods Lab was to really stretch the walls of the academy, to go beyond the academy, to rethink what we do inside the academy, and to mix up our methods from different disciplines. And maybe because it's a smaller campus, we also very influenced by the different subjects in the academy there. So the projects I work on, I would say the creative methods are part of having an intervention, making an intervention in the world. Not only making sociology public, that is an element of it, but it's holding public conversations. At the same time, changing the way we hold our academic conversations. So changing the walls of the academy, making it more of a kind of embodied learning. It's always embodied, but to bring in visuals, texts, aural elements. And with some of the projects, it involves disturbing narratives, regular narratives of places, of how the nation's been constituted, which histories count as a big H, and rethinking that, redoing it, rerouting it, but doing it in a collaborative way, because sociologists can't do everything on their own. We might be able to write, who reads our writing, what kind of writing we even do. That's been evolving over time with me, in thinking about what kind of public intervention we make with our methods.
Yeah. Thanks for those thoughts. And you have done a lot of projects throughout the years, and we might not have a possibility to engage in speaking about all of them, but Which one of your projects or collaborative activities would you think are like especially close to your heart or somehow a bit special that you'd want to remember and talk about now, for example, like if you would need to pick up one in that sense?
Yes, difficult question. Each one has its distinctive way in. But maybe Noise of the Past. So I was only one of many people who led and were at the forefront of the project, including Sanjay Sharma, the academic, Kuldeep Pawar, filmmaker, poet, and the musicians, Nitin Sawhney, and my colleague, the composer, Francis Silkstone. So that project really sought to rethink how the nation creates memory through war rituals and the ways in which that memory is created. It actually has an exclusive element to it, whereby it erases the presence of empire and the presence of the voices, the bodies, the lives, the resources contributed to the two world wars that define British national calendar, World War One and Two. And I always knew that my family was connected to these wars, but they were not the figures who you saw or who you imagined in terms of how the nation remembered. And I had studied and written essays and written articles on ethnicity, nationalism for years. But I wanted to do something beyond the pages of the journal, beyond the academic pages, to do it public and to do it in a site-responsive way in Coventry Cathedral, the city I grew up in and was born in, because it's a site of war and reconciliation and conflict. But to open that reconciliation to the noise of the past from the empire, from colonial, post-colonial bodies, and to do that with film and poetry. And the method we use is probably significant to mention here, taken from dialogic modes of exchange, call and response. Call and response allows for exchange and autonomy. So in the first stage, academics are sharing materials with the two poets, Kuldeep and Swaran Singh, who's my father, who fought in World War II and then came to England in the 50s. It's a classic, you know, war and post-war story. So these materials are shared with them, but also he has his own materials that he's travelled with, his own army documents, British documents. And then Kuldeep posed questions with Urdu poetry to his granddad, and he responded back to him. It wasn't an easy process. It was, you know, he was doing this in his later part of his life when he had several mini strokes. So his friend came in too to help him. Mr. Sharma helped my father with the poetry, and then it was taken to a music studio, Asian music studio in Coventry, produced professionally, given to the musician Nitin Sawhney, who responded with a new score, and then Kuldeep responded to the score with a film which became Unraveling. We had a second element that just grew out the project. You know how projects grow. Mm. And we've been discussing your project, how it's grown in so many ways. Mm. So the offshoot was my colleague Francis Silkstone decided that he wanted to also listen to that poetry between Kuldeep and my father. And he created a new score as well, a live score called Postcolonial War Requiem. And they were performed and screened in Coventry Cathedral. And it's been shown in other places as well, in many places. In fact, the first place Unraveling was shown was in Stockholm at the Reorient Festival. So that was quite a very, very difficult project, I would say, as well, for lots of different reasons. But methodologically, I think the challenge, we learned a lot as well.
Yeah. And was it so that this also has led to a more recent or a bit of a follow-up or some kind of project afterwards as well related to Yes. Some of the themes, at least, from that project.
As you know, Suvi, every project you know has its margins of things that you put on the shelf, which are thrown up before you, you really want to work on immediately, but you need to come back to those once you finish with the task in front of you. And something that has always remained with me are the songs that the women created in the Punjab, in India. The folk songs orally communicated over time and performed, not written down, they're not scribed, about war. And I grew up with those, as a young child. One of them refers to a letter from Burma, how they didn't want this letter from Burma, although they wanted news, because usually the news was bad news. So I'm working with a local community historian and activist, Jyoti Samra, and she has an Asian women's group where they've been meeting for years. And she mentioned to them that Nirmal's interested in some of these songs. They're called Bolian. Do you remember them, about war? And many of them came forward and said yes. And on the 28th of April, actually, we're recording them in Coventry Cathedral. We've recorded them not to be for perform, but to have a record. But it's a site-specific recording. And maybe I'm jumping ahead here, but that will be the next podcast linked to the war cries from the women.
Yeah, and then I thought it might be also interesting to also a bit talk about the collective book, Racist Tones, perhaps because of especially the focus of this podcast, and our project is also related to some of the similar things. So if you can tell a bit about the process around that book, how it developed and what happened?
Yeah.
How did it evolve?
So we were in lockdown at the time, 2020-2021. And the Herbert Art Gallery were putting on an exhibition on the two-tone music movement, which started in the city in the 70s as a movement against the rise of far right, the National Front, which was felt every day on the streets, in football matches, in the city centres. And musicians came together to create this two-tone record label, especially Jerry Dammers being one of them. And this exhibition, as in a lot of local exhibitions, apart from all the material, music materials, ephemera, connected to the music movement, they also wanted local stories. I was very young then, but I did want to offer something. However, I didn't want to just give my words to the gallery. And it does make you think, how do our participants feel when we often ask for interviews? I wanted to have some level of curation or some level of control in how those words travelled. So I contacted three friends who were also young at the time. Again, Jyoti Samra, Tala Patel and Daksha Peparia. And we met online on Zoom, probably met for about six times. We would meet usually on a Friday for a couple of hours. And we started talking about that period and started writing to certain prompts, such as at the windows. For instance, at the windows, your windows might have been smashed or you might have been hiding behind them, looking at the far right, walking down your street, or when I saw a skinhead. And we wrote to many prompts that were created between us. Then we would share, we might write for 5-10 minutes and we would share some of our stories, some of our written pieces and reflect on it together. The gallery had agreed for our conversation to constitute a zine and to be placed in the exhibition. Tala Patel had negotiated that with them, which was really great. interestingly, we had a good problem at the end of our weeks of writing. We had so much text. We had to actually select what we put in to the zine. It was no longer a zine, became a book. My department had given me £1,000, the sociology department, to help with the production of this book. And so each chapter starts, we have 12 chapters, it starts with a prompt, and there's an image that links to the prompt. It's either created by the artist Paul Chokran, who's made the amazing cover on the front of the MG car in green, and then loads of people leaving the football match and what that felt like for people, Asian or black people. And Itala Patel has also made some of the sketches in the book. We've printed it as a risograph book. So it's a particular kind of texture to it. And it sat in the gallery, yes. We also did sell a lot of copies in the book, in the bookshop, gift shop of the gallery. And we at the time had an economy whereby £5 would go towards anti-racist work in the gallery and £5 towards reproducing more. So that project's a quite interesting model, I think, for what many people can do, how you come together. There are also challenges in terms of distribution, because we're not distributors. How do we share it? Of course, you can put the book online, and then it becomes more available to people as well.
So how did the word spread about that book? Was it through just people talking to each other, or did you actually do some kind of like work with trying to get people to know about the book? Or?
Yeah, a lot of people came to the exhibition. So that was one route. But we also did public events. So we held a launch in the city with Warwick University, and that's where we launched the book. We held a writing session, and then at that time in Goldsmiths, we were able to put it on lots of publicity on the website. So the word grew in that way. I'm sure if we produced more copies, paper copies, we could distribute them further. We've also given copies to the local libraries and university libraries. So there are many channels for distribution.
Yeah, and did the pandemic have some effect on it, like more on the process, other than that it started during it, or did it complicate somehow the process, or like?
I actually think the fact that we could meet on Zoom helped to create something, to create moments of togetherness, but also moments of silence where we're writing. So we could have moments of discipline. Maybe if we'd met in cafes many times, we would have just been really unruly and had a great time and not got onto the task for a few weeks. Mm-hmm. But so it helped that we were meeting online, so the online format. But of course, because of the pandemic, we were used to meeting online. And a lot of us were already doing writing initiatives online. All four of us were doing that.
Yeah, so sometimes also the hindrances can be like a way forward, or finding new avenues to do things in a meaningful way in that sense. Well, yeah, then you have a very influential book that was published in 2004 that was titled Space Invaders, Race, Gender, Bodies, Out of Place, that many people know of you based on this book. And there's also been recently a special issue published in the European Journal of Cultural Studies where people engage with your work and these concepts, and also think about how can they be used in different contexts and different kinds of analysis. So could you tell just a bit about the concept of space invaders and the collective space well, sorry, the collective space invading, which I understood. I'd like to a bit different approaches. So what do you mean with these concepts, and how would you see that these ideas have lived since then?
Yeah, so yeah, the book Space Invaders really is premised on thinking through what happens when bodies enter spaces that they have not been expected to occupy historically or conceptually. What happens in that process? And it tries to complicate the notion of inclusion or diversity. It rethinks the conditions of inclusion, how there are certain elements involved in that disorientation. So the normative bodies, for instance, become disoriented when there's someone not quite expected to be in that role. How there's a burden of doubt attached to that person so that the most minor of mistakes can become amplified. And how do they get infantilized? Clearly, I get that word from Fanon. How do they get infantilized, seem to be much more junior than they are? And often they're under super surveillance, as I said. So any error or mistake is not forgiven. It seemed to be a sign of a displaced body in place. I had looked at very formal institutions such as senior civil service and women and racialized members of parliament. I did 100 interviews with that research. But the book traveled to many places. It was picked up by scientists, by museum practitioners, by artists, and it had this other life that's way beyond what I had envisaged. And those processes also operate, give or take, you know, the way in which they operate in academia too. It includes looking at how people are sponsored into spaces, for instance. So the weight of your mentor or your sponsor makes a big difference to how you're received, and your educational trajectories too. The elite universities, the elite education, all of that is part of the conditions of inclusion, or what one of my participants called having the soft skills as well as the hard skills. And when I probed what he meant by soft skills, he means the way you compose yourself, the way you speak, the manner in which you write, whether veneer is more important than the content. So the issues of visibility and invisibility. That was written 20 years ago, and the political landscape is very different now. There are many more racially minoritized politicians at local and national and European levels. And more so, there is this been growing right-wing agenda, mainstreaming of far-right agendas, which is also being conducted by racialized minorities in different ways. Now, the 20th anniversary issue came out of a conference that was organized from City University by Jo Littler and her colleagues. And the special issue has been pushed through by Jo Littler and Annemiek Saha from the European Journal of Cultural Studies. So I think we have 21 essays in there. And it's not a way of kind of mirroring the book, but it's uses the book, those essays take the book as a launching pad into other areas, into connected ideas. So we have essays on, or articles on, the woman and life freedom, on Gaza, on migration from Brazil, on slavery and abolition, there's so on neurodiversity, on trans wars. It's really vast. So museums, I mean, the work has been used quite a lot with Siobhan McGurk and Catherine Han to think through museums in terms of gender as well as racialized processes. And Roshani too has a piece on museums in there. It's really grown. I mean, it's it's been a very much a big pleasure to work with that idea, but seeing it being expanded in many ways. So moving on to space invading, it was pointed out to me when I was doing Noise of the Past and other creative projects that maybe instead of now I'm not looking at space invaders, but I'm actually undertaking space invading, creatively undertaking space invading. So expanding places, resituating places, taking them in directions they're not expected to be in, and rethinking them. So I do have a chapter in the collection called Expanded Spatial Practice.
Yeah. And then maybe we can invite all the readers to have a look at the special issue and get to know more about these thoughts. But before we finish up, I also wanted to ask you about podcasts. That part of your work has also been and is continuing to be to produce podcasts. You're a bit like hinged on what you're doing now, but maybe you can just tell a bit more about what you're working on now and what would be the next episode in your podcast, and people can go also over to listen to that say if they want.
Yes, more listening. Yeah. The podcast is called Hear Hear, and I've taken that word, you may know, in the British Parliament, in the chamber where all the drama occurs, that you will hear the phrase "hear, hear" as a way of supporting someone. But I've taken it in a different direction to say, look, listen to "hear, hear." So it's a site-responsive way of listening. And all of the series has been from Coventry Cathedral because I worked on a project called Multicultural Experiments in the Civic Life of a Cathedral. And I looked at how quite unusual forms of multicultural organizing, anti-racist activism was in the cathedral from the 50s, 60s onwards. And usually it's not present in the way in which the history or the architecture of the building, the stories that come with it are told. And I invited guests who brought their own specialisms to the cathedral and to the cathedral archives to rethink the building, to rehear here. And I've been very, very special. It's been very, very special to have the guests, because sometimes a guest can actually help you to feel at home in a place that you've been trying to find a place in. The next episode will be a little bit unusual from the others, where my guests will be singing the bullion, the songs, the war cries. And maybe in that one, my voice will come out a bit more than the earlier episodes have. Because the way in which the podcasts have been designed, not intentionally, but I've realized that being a, practice social researcher who's always used interviews, you're very used to asking a question and listening intently. And that's what I've done across the podcast. So I don't actually say a lot myself. And in the next one, I will probably say a slightly more to introduce the bullion and give them context. Then people can listen to the bullion in Punjabi. And I also should mention Duncan Whitley. He's the producer of the podcast, and he's got a very special listening ear. He works on sound himself, theorizing sound, and he does also have an essay in the 20th anniversary of Space Invaders on the sounds of Parliament.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Nirmal, for those thoughts, and thank you very much for the whole interview and your visit here, and we hope to meet you soon again.
Thank you.